the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Amanda Banta is an adjunct instructor at Gonzaga's MBA program and a registered financial investment advisor. Prior to that, she competed for the USA rifle team in the 2012 London Olympics, a goal she set at the age of 13. She speaks about the lessons of an elite athlete and how they apply to a variety of facets in life.
Hello, good morning.
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing very, very well. I am honored. I'm actually honored to be in the presence of an Olympian. This is going to be amazing for me. I'll try not to be so starstruck here, but
oh my gosh, you're so kind. Thank you. we've been around each other before, so
I know. So very, very good to see you, and thanks for joining us. I've absolutely loved doing these podcasts, just meeting all the amazing people that are involved with Gonzaga. So you were a no-brainer.
Thank you. Yeah, no kidding. Gonzaga's full of some fantastic alumni and faculty. It's an exciting place.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, we kind of have a formula here, and today we're going to talk about you. It's going to be fun. Recently saw in the Spokesman Review an awesome article about some of your achievements on the Olympic front, but we'll get there. We'll get there.
But okay.
Let's start with where it all began. I believe you're from Spokane originally, so I'll let you kind of talk about where you grew up and how you kind of ended up where you are.
Yeah. So I'm born and raised in Spokane. I didn't start shooting till I was 11, which is actually, that's actually really young when you're talking about, you know, we're shooting rifles. I started shooting when I was 11. My sister was the shooter initially. So she's older than me, and my dad got her into the sport. And I was just the annoying little sister that wanted to do whatever she did. So naturally, I begged my dad to bring me to the Spokane Junior Rifle Club, let me shoot with my sister and all of her friends. And that's where we got started, was at the local club here in Spokane. And it just grew from there. When you're involved in something that's kind of unique, you know, there's not a lot of advertisements for it. You don't know a ton of people that are doing it. You don't really know the depth of where you can take this, what you can do. And we started hearing about different competitions we can go to, and they were, you know, statewide and then regional. And then we figured out you can go to college from a shooting scholarship, or it's an Olympic sport. And we had no idea when my dad first got my sister and I involved. And we kind of dove in head first. I loved the sport. I was super competitive. I still am. And one thing kind of led to another, and we just found ourselves in the midst of this great Olympic sport, where we had this opportunity to grow and to be part of the Olympic movement and get on a college team. And it was truly incredible.
So was your dad a shooter? Was he into it? Was he?
He was, yes. he was in the Army, and he loved shooting his entire life, and eventually was a coach of, oh my gosh, I have to remember what team it was, but he ended up coaching at some point in his life. And then when he moved to Spokane, joined the Spokane Rifle Club and found out about the junior program. And so he was actually a coach down there at the Spokane Junior Rifle Club. Okay. And he coached me and my sister, along with the other shooters at the club, for my entire career, at least. And then he still volunteers down there, coaches. He's very involved in the rifle community. So yeah, he's a fantastic coach. A really good shooter in his own right. He does different style. There's all different kinds of shooting. So okay. He doesn't do the same kind of shooting that I do. He coaches that, but he shoots in other disciplines.
Okay. So you're growing up, are you playing other sports? Are you guys, you're playing soccer and everything? Are you?
So up until the point where I was very actively shooting, I was doing everything else. So, you know, I did soccer in elementary school. I did dance, jazz and tap, not super serious, but just kind of for fun. And I'm very feminine. So yeah, I was really into like, I'm going to be a country singer and a fashion designer and a dancer, you know, everything that you can possibly think
Why
of.
Not? Why not? Yeah.
But then I went to my first national competition when I was 13. My dad bought me my first competition rifle that was mine. So I had been borrowing one from the junior club, but I qualified for the National Junior Olympic Championships, which was my first national competition in Colorado Springs. And basically that's, it's kind of like national championships, but for everybody under the age of 21. Okay. So it's like the biggest junior competition that you can imagine, that they're holding at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. And I qualified at 13 for the youngest age group. And so my dad bought me my first competition rifle that was just mine. And, you know, I wanted the blue rifle. So I picked the color of the rifle I wanted.
That's
and it
cool.
was,
That's cool.
It was fabulous. But I went to the Junior Olympics and I saw all of these girls and these women that were fantastic shooter. I did my research before I went and I knew the names of all of the, you know, the top shooters, and I was seeing them walking around. And I remember telling my dad, I don't think that I can do this. There's no way that I can beat so-and-so, you know, when I'm watching them, they're so serious. And I was not quite there yet, but, I ended up winning my age group. So the youngest age group, and I beat the girl that I thought that I could never beat. So it was really exciting. I set a national record for my age group at that competition. And on the way back, we were driving in the rental car on the way to the airport. And I told my dad, I'm going to quit dance and I'm going to quit soccer. And I'm going to be an Olympic shooter at 13.
That's so cool. So for someone ignorant like me, give me an idea of the competition. I mean, is there, and you said there's different kinds of shooting. Are you like a prone shooter? Are we, what's the distance?
Sure. Okay, yeah.
Without getting too, I'm sure there's some technical aspects you can get into, but.
Yeah, I'll give you the rundown. So kind of like 5,000 foot overview, 500 foot overview, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
So first of all, the rules of the sport change rather frequently. So pretty, you know, the exact way that the competition's framed can change, like the time limits and stuff. But essentially when I was competing, and when I went to the Olympics, I'm shooting with a 22 rifle. At the Olympic style, it's at 50 meters. So it's half of a football field, and we're shooting at a target that's about the size of a CD or like an orange. The 10 rings, like the size of your pinky nail, like the X rings, the size of your pinky nail, 10 ring, the size of a dime at 50 meters. And my competition, so I did 50 meter three position, and I shot other events as well, but my Olympic event was 50 meter three position. And so that means that I'm shooting 20 competition shots in prone, which is laying down, 20 competition shots in standing, and then 20 in kneeling. And okay. We have sighters before each position. So you get a feel for the position, make sure that your sights are on, your position's right, the rifle's set up correctly. But then as soon as you hit like go, you have 20 competition shots you have to take. You can't step out of those competition shots. You know, you have 20 shots. So if you mess up, there's no like, okay, let's go back into sighters and see how we're doing. It's like, you're in competition. You have to know how to make your fixes and your changes as you're going. But we have about 2 hours. So when I was competing, we had 2 hours to shoot those 60 competition shots, which, yes, that's a lot of time. But when you're trying to get all of those 60 shots in the size of your pinky nail at 50 meters, you need all the time that you can get to make sure your positions are correct in between, and to take the time to gather your thoughts and to maintain your mental acuity and energy throughout that 2 hour time period. And deep breathing and visualization. And there's just so much that goes into it. It's like, you're trying to be as calm and as mentally aware as possible for that 2-hour time limit. It's kind of insane, actually.
Wow. And so breathing, I think, some based on the movies I've seen with snipers and things like that, breathing's important, right? Your timing, your trigger squeeze, is that correct? Or am I?
Yeah, kind of. So I would say that most people get their exposure to shooting from Hollywood. Right. And some of the things are accurate. I would definitely say they're getting more accurate, but like my husband and I like to watch the movies and be like, oh my gosh, why are they doing that? They're totally wrong. Or that's not safe. Or, oh my gosh, it's not even loaded. Like, you know, that kind of thing. But in reality, yes. So when I was shooting, I was not consciously telling myself to pull the trigger. It's like, it's this whole process where I'm going through a visualization thing and my eyes are closed and I'm breathing and I'm imagining taking the shot before I'm even my fingers on the trigger. So I'm in position, imagining I'm taking my shot. I open my eyes and then I repeat exactly what I was doing, which was deep breathing, looking down my sights, settling onto the target. And then as soon as my sights would settle onto the target, it's a slow process, you know, the sights come down into the target and you see it kind of settle and my body's naturally pulling the trigger. So I'm never making a conscious decision like, okay, pull, you know, it's more of a natural process that we, even then after the shot, we follow through. So it's a really steady, slow thing that you're going through to actually take your shot.
That's fascinating. And I grew up as a ski racer, and some of what you're saying resonates in that, you know, your equipment is just almost just like a part of you, right? Mm-hmm. It's a part of a larger movement.
Yeah, so that's really cool. Ski racing, I didn't know that. Very cool.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't much of anything. Don't. I'm making that sound bigger than I was. But
okay. So I actually did. So I worked with a local sports psychologist here, Dr. Charbonneau, and I don't know if he's still working in the field, but I started working with him from the age of 13 through high school. And we did a lot of biofeedback training. And, you know, you mentioned your equipment becomes an extension of yourself. That's what my rifle was. So we got it to the point where, you know, I had all these things attached to my brain, my head and my, you know, wherever you can feel sweat, heart rate, that kind of thing. And we got to the point where I could control my heart rate with my breathing, but also to the point where when I picked up my rifle or I imagined picking up my rifle, my heart rate would actually drop. So it really was like an extension of myself. Rather than getting nervous when I would pick up the rifle or think about shooting the rifle, I would pick up the rifle or think about it and I would relax.
Wow. The first time you shot, were you awesome? Were you just like a natural and then obviously worked to the Olympic level?
No, I was like terrible. I was like every newbie at something. I was so bad. I don't know. So many people have heard this story before because I tell it all the time, but it's hilarious. The first time my sister used to practice at home with her air rifle, and that's a totally normal thing to do with an air rifle. It's a pellet gun. We had a pellet trap. But my dad, I begged him to let me shoot and I was still too young to join the junior club here. So he set up this, like, you know, the giant refrigerator boxes, they're huge. He set that up as a backstop on our garage and he gave me like a,
this is a very Spokane move. I like it.
Yeah. This is odd, but now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, this is kind of weird, but this is, I don't know. It's just part of my life. Yeah. So I had some kind of BB gun. It wasn't the full size air rifle. It was some kind of BB gun. And he put a target in the middle of the refrigerator box. And I was about 10 meters away, which is the air rifle distance. And I missed the target, missed the refrigerator box, and was shooting dents into his garage. And so no, I was not great when I first started, and he will not get rid of those dents in the garage. They're still there to this day. So while it was embarrassing at this point, it's just really funny how terrible I was. And but you think about, like, when you start anything, you might be bad. You're probably bad when you first start, and it takes the discipline and the training to get good at something. You can miss by extreme amounts at the beginning, but if you dedicate yourself enough, you can take yourself far.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, And I think this is one of the benefits of, as you say, dedicating yourself to something in all aspects. And you learn a lot about yourself and what you can do. And I think that can translate to a lot of things.
Oh, yeah. And I find that the things that I train myself for, the things that I went through in sport, apply so much to life now. And, you know, since I've been shooting, they just, every aspect of my life and work and raising my children, there's a lot of the same, a lot of the same things apply now.
So you win Junior Olympics at 13. So now you're on.
Sorry, correction, for my age group.
And so now you're on coach's radar at the national level, I would imagine, right? This is, so what's kind of the next step at that point?
Yeah, at that point, I told you that I decided I'm going to be an Olympic shooter. And that's a pretty big goal for somebody that's just won the youngest age group at, you know, their first national match. But I was like, I'm going to be an Olympic shooter. So, and that does put you on the national coach's radar. College coaches get kind of interested. They can't do anything with it, but it's like, oh, here's a name, you know, just kind of in the back of my mind or on a list to look up in the future. And, but I was determined. I'm like, I'm going to make the national team, like the full national team, not just the junior team. But, so I remember I set up a call with the national coach. My dad probably set up the call. I'm like, I don't know who set this up, but he wasn't calling me, but I know that we set it up at some point. And I was asking him questions like, what do I do to make the national team? How do I get there? Do I have a chance? You know? And to me, the national coach was just like this monumental figure. Like, he's the one that runs the show. Like, this is who I've got to impress. I got to get on this team. And I was so motivated and inspired at this point. At that point, like, dropped everything else, dedicated myself to shooting. I told my parents, like, I'm in this, we're going to do it. And my parents were totally on board. They were like, hey, if you're going to do this, you know, you're going to do it though. We're not just going to, this, you know, costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time and energy, not just from my side, but from my parents' side. Mm-hmm. So they're like, if you're going to do it, like, we're going all in. So from that point, we started figuring out every national match that I can compete in. Cause that was part of the advice from the coach, was you need to compete more at a higher level to get more experience, to improve your own skills, to observe other athletes. So we started figuring out every national match that I could go to, altered my training schedule. That's when we got into the sports psychology training and the physical training. I mean, we just jumped into everything. And so I just started competing at national matches more. That was my friend group too. You know, I was at this point, oh my gosh, was I in high school? Was I in eighth grade? I don't even know at this point. But my friends shifted from my friends at school to my friends on the shooting team, because that's where my mind was. That's where my goals were bigger than whatever was happening in eighth or ninth grade. So my friend group really shifted to the friends on the national team, and we would all look forward to seeing each other at the matches, and we would train, you know, with each other, kind of texting each other, oh, what did you shoot today? That kind of thing. So I had been trying to get on the national team basically since that point at that first junior national match, and every other national match, they have stipulations for making the national team. Whether it was, you know, you had to be top three, top two, first place, it would depend on the match, but it was laid out before the competition. So at every competition, I was trying to make the national team. And I found that at this point, I was basically always like one place off from making the team. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, I'm never going to make it. Come on. You know, I was always like third place when you had to be top two, or I was like fourth place when you had to be top three. It just felt like I was constantly like almost there, but not quite. And so, you know, I had doubts at some point, am I ever going to make the team? Is this ever going to happen? And this is just the national team. This is not the Olympic team that I'm talking about. This is like the team that goes to World Cups and is funded, to shoot, you know, to travel and shoot. And I finally qualified when I was 16 for the Pan American Games. So I kept not making it for, you know, this international match or this international match. But then the big one comes around, you know, Pan American Games tryouts. That's a big international competition where all the sports are competing. And I qualified. So it was like one big jump I made it from not being funded, not being on the team, to suddenly like, hey, you're like Team USA is like putting this on. Like, we get all the gear and we get the support and we get to go and compete while all the other sports are competing. And I'm like 16, like in the middle of this whirlwind. Pan American Games were down in Brazil that year, and I won a bronze medal. So it wasn't my first international competition. So after I qualified for the national team, my first match was in Australia. Like, it wasn't just some random match that I went to. They're like, hey, we're going to fly you halfway across the world and you're going to go to Sydney, Australia for your first World Cup. And then it was like Germany, China, just a slew of places that first year. And I'm still in high school. Like, you know, these matches are like March, April, May. I'm missing a ton of school, but traveling the world and competing. And it went on like that for my entire the rest of my high school career. Was just like 2 months out of the year, I was traveling and competing. And I went to Mead High School in, you know, North Spokane. And the school and my teachers were so fabulous. They helped me do this. They didn't say like, oh, I'm sorry, you can't compete on an international level. We need you to finish your English, or we need you to finish your PE credits. Like, they were very helpful in assisting me with this and making sure that I could do both, and I could do both well.
That's incredible. You talk about friends kind of shifting, and in my experience, that there's a unique bond with the people that are going through the same kind of sport that you are, which can be pretty, pretty special. Random question for you. Is there any, when you're at a competition in Australia, and that's pretty awesome to have expenses paid trip to Australia. Granted, you're probably not going to the beach or something like that, but is there, I don't want to use I was thinking trash talk, but like, is there intimidate, like, are they trying to psychologically mess with you at all? Some sports have that, right? Where you're kind of like staring someone down, or is there anything like that going on?
Like other competitors?
Like the Australians or the Germans. Or the...
Oh my gosh. I'm trying to think of it. That'd be so odd for somebody to be like vindictive like that, you know? But, you know, sometimes sabotage does happen. And I feel like it's so extreme though. Like, I never experienced it on the national team, but I had teammates that had experienced sabotage, where somebody would take like, if they hadn't secured their gear properly in their rifle, somebody had a screwdriver stuck down the barrel of their rifle and, you know, messed with, and that changes the trajectory of the bullet flying from your barrel. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that does happen. It is not the norm. It is very rare that would happen. And if it does, it's, you know, it's awful. It's terrible to have that feeling. Shooting, at least when I was competing, is a very close community. Kind of everybody knows everybody, everybody's friends.
That's cool.
I still have a group of international friends, you know, that I met from the sport, and everybody's very supportive of each other for the most part. And even within the team, you know, it's an individual sport. So yes, you qualify, you're part of the U.S. national team, but you're competing against the other people on your team that have also qualified. Right. And sometimes you could think there could be some animosity there, you know, some grievances against your teammates. But for the most part, everybody is super supportive, good friends. It's a really fun community. But yeah, you did mention, you had said, you know, you go to Australia and probably not on the beaches. So when we're traveling for these trips, we usually get there, you have to get adjusted to the environment there. So you do have to get there a little bit early for the most part. You don't always get the luxury of showing up early. You know, you train for half the day, but then you do have time to go and do other things in these places. So I've got to see some really amazing things traveling all over the world, you know, the Great Wall of China and the Sydney Opera House and everywhere you can think of in Munich, basically. But all these places I've been, I have got to see. I do a lot of sightseeing and things.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, so Pan American Games, some international stuff, and then pretty soon it's college time, right?
Yeah. Oh my God, college. So, college is great. Let's. So I 2008. I'm a junior in high school, and I try out for my first Olympics. So the 2008 Games in China, and I would say that at this point I'd been competing on Team USA for the US team for, you know, a year and a half. And I was doing really well. So I thought, wow, I have a shot at making the Olympic team at 17. And that would be very young for competing in the Olympics. But I didn't make that team. I was third place, and you had to be first or second. So I was Olympic team alternate, which, despite being so young, that was really depressing for me, given that I had sacrificed so much of my time and energy to make that team. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm there for. I'm not competing it is fun to compete, but I'm not competing for fun. So I'm competing to compete on the national team to go to the Olympics, and I don't make the team. So yeah, people will say, well, you're only 17, but yeah, I gave up a lot to do this, and it took a lot of my time, money, energy to do it. And I didn't make that team. And so I felt after that, I wasn't sure if I wanted to keep doing that. How much more time and energy do I want to give up for this goal that might not ever happen? What I did know was going to happen was that college was in the future, and I was being recruited by a few schools. And, you know, I thought West Point sounded great, but they didn't have a fashion program. So West Point was off the table. That's kind of a joke because, while I was interested in competing at West Point, I at the time wanted to be a fashion major, and they didn't have fashion. So I was looking at University of Kentucky, University of Memphis, and there's actually quite a few schools that offer shooting programs. But I was pretty set on one because my best friend at the time was competing at University of Kentucky, and everybody was sure that I was going to join her there. And my dad had been researching what schools are offering scholarships. So he found that Ohio State had a rifle team, and they had just recently instituted scholarships for the rifle team. Okay. And so I was like, Dad, I'm not going to Ohio. Like, it's cornfields. Like, I'm not going to Ohio State. I was imagining like this podunk town, you know, smaller than Spokane, like... it's just what was in my head. And my dad's like, the Fisher College of Business is there. You need to at least check it out. Just do me a favor, at least go look. And if you don't like it, you don't have to go. And so he set up a visit. I talked to the coach, and my mom went with me. And I remember flying into Columbus, Ohio, and being like, okay, this is not cornfields. This is a city. There's like 60,000 students there. I mean, it's insane. They took me to a football game, and it was done. Like, I was like, okay, where's the paperwork? We're signing. It was so cool. I got to go on the field. Like, LeBron James was at that game. It was like, I mean, it was so awesome. I'm like, I'm buying a jersey. Like, you hand me the paperwork. We're signing. I'm going to Ohio State. I'm a Buckeye. Like, the deal was done after my visit. So I decided to shoot at Ohio State, and, best decision I made as far as my, academic athletic career could have gone. So I received a scholarship for it was like, because I was an out-of-stater and my grades were a certain level and test scores, I got some academic scholarship, and then the rest was athletic. So I got a full scholarship, which is awesome. Nearly unheard of in the rifle community. And it wasn't because I wouldn't say it was because I am who I am. It was because it was like the perfect set of circumstances of, yeah, I'm a high level shooter, but I'm also going to a school that's still building up their program and their scholarship program. So it was just the perfect set of circumstances to get school paid for, be part of the Fisher College of Business, and compete on their rifle team.
That's awesome. I noticed you didn't call it the Ohio State. You just said Ohio State.
You know, sometimes I do, but for the most part, no.
Okay, so you're in Columbus. It's an awesome experience, and you're competing at the NCAA. Any big events there? Did we win nationals or anything like that? Or
I competed at the NCAA championships all of my years at Ohio State. My first 3 years, and my fourth year I wasn't competing, and I'll get to that in a minute because people get confused, like, why didn't you compete a fourth year? Yeah. So my first 3 years, yeah, I competed at the NCAA championships. I don't even remember how I did because that wasn't my focus. And I'm so terrible at remembering, like, did I win anything? I didn't win any of the NCAA national championships. I didn't win it. I know that for sure. But I'm like, I don't even remember what I placed because I wasn't thinking about, my focus wasn't on the NCAAs. My focus was on Team USA stuff.
Okay.
And college shooting for me was training for Olympic shooting. And I don't want to say that in a way that sounds like I was taking it lightly at college. I absolutely was not. It just, when you're competing in competitions nonstop, at some point, like, you stop worrying about, like, okay, did I win this? Did I win that? What medal do I have? Like, you stop thinking about it. You're just competing and training nonstop. It was a fantastic experience my first 3 years there. Really hard to manage being a student, an athlete, and trying to have some kind of a normal college life and experience. Yeah.
So what would be a typical day? I mean, are you getting up at 5 a.m. and hitting the weight room, or
So they had our practice started at 7:30 in the morning, and we practiced 5 days a week and then had competitions on weekends during the season. So practice was 7:30 to 10:30, and then we would have classes, and that was basically every day. But you think about it, it's essentially being like, hey, we want you to go to your classes just like every other college student, but get good grades enough to maintain your scholarship. But also, here's a full-time job. Can you do that too? And then, like, try and be mentally healthy if you can, and, like, take care of your body also. So it's like, here's two full-time jobs while you're 18, 19, you know, 20, 21. So it's a lot of responsibility. And I think people forget that. They see student athletes and they forget that how much they're carrying on their shoulders. So, and for me, it was like, yeah, college, maintain my grades, which it was bad my freshman year. I'll admit that. At least in the beginning, because it was so new to, like, manage going to the classes and that workload. And, you know, then I finally figured out the system and buckled down and figured out so I was studying between my classes. I would go to practice in the morning for 3 hours, go to my classes. In between my classes, I was studying in the student center or the athlete center, student athlete center. You know, hit my workout, go to more classes, study in the evenings, and then, you know, try and have some social time as well. So there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I see it here. You know, and you said full-time job. That's exactly how I describe it.
Yeah. Well, and then you throw Team USA stuff on there. So then they're like, okay, but now can you take 2 weeks off of your schedule to come to this World Cup, or like 3 weeks so that we can hit two World Cups and then go back to college? And like, so like now I'm studying on the road and like training. It's just like so much stuff going on.
So you've been all over the world, I'm imagining now. I mean,
yeah. There's two continents I haven't been to. I've never been to Africa and I've never been to Antarctica. Okay. Everywhere else I've been.
Okay. Yeah. If you make it to Antarctica, we'll have another pod episode on that.
So. Oh, I'm totally going. I have my eye on this, like, this luxury cruise from Argentina.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm definitely going to do it.
My son's friend's dad had done multiple stints at, I think it's called McMurdo Station.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And he likes it so much that, like, they max you out. There's a time where they're like, you gotta go back you can't just be down here all the time. I don't know if it's like 18 months or 2 years.
Oh my gosh.
But here's what he told me about it. He said in winter when it's dark all the time, they have ropes between different buildings and places. Cause if, when there's snowstorms, you can't see anything. You just, if you have to go across the street, you just grab the rope and follow the rope to the, across the street or wherever you're going, the next building. But I digress. But I hope you make it there at some point. So.
Thanks. Yeah. That also is like kind of a deterrent. I'm like, I don't want to go there in the winter. I really don't.
Yeah. 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 I mean, summer would be super fun. And they have, I mean, they do, I mean, there's stuff there. There's like, I think there's like a pub and there's cross country skiing and
wow,
like a basketball court and stuff like that. So
there's no rest range. So I couldn't have competed there.
Yeah. Right. So we're working our way towards 2012 London. I'm imagining, right. Given the time frame. Okay.
Yeah. So I was a junior in college and I watched. So at this point I was kind of like, if the Olympics happens, that'd be wonderful. Obviously that'd be great. But right now I kind of shifted my focus from making the Olympic team to getting through college and getting good grades and doing a good job as an athlete there. And then I watched one of my friends make the Olympic team in air rifle. So not my event, but I watched her make the team in air rifle in the winter. And my tryouts were going to be in the spring. And I was like, I want that. I want to go to the Olympics with her. So, and I want this for myself. Obviously, it wasn't just about my friend, but it like re-sparked my interest and my dedication to like, I can do this. I want to be on the Olympic team too. So I called the national coach and was like, can you give me a room at the training center? I'm going to miss the rest of the year at college and I'm going to come train full time for the tryouts. That's what I wanted to do. I talked to my coach at Ohio State about it. I was able to do online classes. And we had finished our series, said, yeah, as soon as the season ends, go, you can take this time off. So, you know, that's one way that like the school, Ohio State, was so supportive of what I was doing. To even be able to do that is, to me, it's looking back, I'm like, that's insane. That was so much support that they had, so much belief in me to be able to say, hey, take this time off and go do what you need to do and then come back. So I, within days, basically was at the Olympic Training Center training full time. And I was doing my online classes and traveling all over for training events and smaller competitions before Olympic trials. And then I felt so good. Like I was really, I was doing really great, like with my mental side of things. I was working with a sports psychologist, doing my Bible studies, working out. Like it was my full-time job, was how can I be the best athlete that I can be? And, it worked in my favor. I felt great going into Olympic trials. My thought that was different from 2008 was not, this is all I have. I have to make the team. Look at all that I've given up for it. But instead, my mindset was, I'm so prepared for this. I feel fantastic. I'm competing better than I've ever competed. I can do this. But if I don't, it's okay. Because I get to go back to college and I have this wonderful life that I'm building outside of sport. And I just felt really good. And I carried that all the way through trials. I felt confident. I felt great. I don't remember if I was leading the whole time in trials, but maybe I was. I don't know. It didn't matter to me. I was doing the best that I could do. It didn't matter what everybody else was doing. But I ended up winning that competition and qualified for the 2012 games. And my parents were there and we were crying. And it was just like a full circle moment of like, look at all this that you've done. And now look what you get to go do. Like you earned this spot. It was a really, really wonderful moment then.
So are you in the opening ceremonies?
Yeah, of course. And so it's like, it's kind of feisty in there. Like, well, first of all, I'll get to that. But so everybody's, it's so weird. I tried to explain this to somebody the other day and I'm like, so imagine that you're in Times Square, right? And this is the leading up to opening ceremonies. Like you're at the Olympic Village. You all have these meeting places where you meet up to walk into opening ceremonies, and it's outside of the stadium. So you have to walk like all the way to the stadium. So at that point, You're mingling with people, but like, imagine you're in Times Square. Okay. And like, you're, you know, there's tons of tourists there and you're always bumping into people and you're like, okay, you're in my way. Like, look out. Like, there's all these people. But at opening ceremonies, when you're walking to the stadium, it's the same kind of feeling. Like, there's so many people and you're just like bumping into people. But every time you bump into somebody, you're like, oh my God, like, that's so-and-so, or like, that's Simone Biles, or like, you know, that wasn't my case, but like, you're bumping into somebody that you're like, oh my gosh, like, you're one of the best people in the world at this. And like, they're bumping into people that are like, oh my gosh, that's so-and-so from volleyball or swimming, or like, I mean, you're just like this crowd of literally the best, strangest people in the world, like all bumping into each other, like trying to get into opening ceremonies. And once you get into the arena though, for opening ceremonies, everybody's vying for the front line, right?
Oh, so okay.
Finally though, when we were about to walk into the stadium, you know, you're underground and or you're in like the tunnel, whatever it's called. I don't know. I wasn't a football player. Like, you're in the tunnel. Yeah. You're under there and you're hearing like this roar, and like as they announce Team USA, everybody's chanting USA, USA. And you're about to enter this stadium where there's flashing lights and like this chant happening. And me and a couple friends, we locked arms and we got to the front of the line. So we're right behind the flag bearer in the 2012 ceremonies. So my friends were like, oh my gosh, we see you. Like, I had all these text messages and pictures from the TV screen. Like, you're right behind the flag bearer. So it was a really exciting experience. It's one of the best things that you can experience as an Olympic athlete. Just so much excitement. You feel like, wow, like I did this, I made this happen. And you lose the feeling of being, you know, so-and-so from this sport or so-and-so from this sport, but you really feel like we're all equals here. Like, we're all Team USA. And it's a really uniting and thrilling experience.
That's awesome. I'm going to look for something on YouTube to, hey, I know that person. What's the Olympic Village like? I envision, hey, I want an omelet or I want steak and eggs, and it's in the morning and I just walk down to the corner and I get steak and eggs. Like, is that, I mean, and is it like, are they nice dorms? What are we talking about here?
So they're kind of like, at least in the London Village, so they set up, I mean, it's a village, it's like a little mini city.
Okay.
And there's different things that you can go do in different places you could go. There's like a little store, a little UPS plate, UPS, whatever it is, a mail place. Yeah. I don't know what it was there, whatever it was, a mail place, and, you know, places to go eat. And actually in the place to go eat, they have all different cuisines from all over the world because all the athletes are eating there. It's not just Team USA, it's all the athletes.
Right.
And they have McDonald's in there. So you can like go and get your fries and your shake, you know?
Yeah,
but totally. You can also get other stuff. It's kind of like kind of buffet style, I guess. But yeah, so you would eat in those places. But then the housing was, it was kind of like these hotels. So they would put up these hotels or apartment buildings. And, you know, your sport would have like a floor or a certain section of rooms. And I had a roommate who was my friend that qualified, also an air rifle. So one of my best friends, we were roommates, and neither of us were tidy at the time. And keep in mind that, first of all, you show up with all of your gear, all of the stuff that you've brought, your clothes, your gear, all that, and then they give you like an entire, like two full wardrobes of new clothes and sponsor gear. It looked like our room exploded with like Nike, Ralph Lauren, like gear. We just had stuff everywhere, and I remember taking a picture of being like, "This is embarrassing," but also like, "Oh my gosh, look at all this stuff! This is wild." So like, we have these. The beds aren't big; they're smaller. You know, they're trying to set up basically a city for all of these temporary athletes that are there. So they're not big or anything, but we had our own space and it was perfectly fine. Really good resources and amenities, you know, but it's not luxury living. Like you would think that maybe their athletes are walking into a very luxurious environment. Like that's not really the case. It's a very temporary, it's very temporary circumstances. So no, it's not luxurious at all, but, it's an exciting environment to be in.
Sure.
So you're walking around and seeing all the different athletes from all over the world. And it's just really, it's really cool.
Is there room service? I mean, do they come turn?
No.
They don't clean your room.
No, I'll stop that question there. No, there's no room service. Like, you get your own stuff.
I used the wrong word. I mean, do they clean? Do they come clean for you? Like, they come change your sheets and stuff like that? Like a hotel?
You know, that's a good question. I don't even remember. Yeah. But me saying I don't remember is I feel like they don't. I feel like you're just there, like, doing your own thing. Like,
yeah,
maybe we were able to switch our sheets and stuff. I really don't remember at this point. They had, like, a cool, on a certain floor, they had a level where you could go and hang out with other, you know, athletes from Team USA. So each building basically was, like, their own country. So, like, we had, like, Team USA building. So there wasn't other countries within our building, but there were other sports. So all the sports are kind of mixed up. But you go hang out, you know, with other athletes on a certain floor, and they had, you know, snacks and other sponsors. I'm like, who are the sponsors? There were, like, you know, sponsor snacks and that kind of thing. Then you could sign up for event tickets. So if I wanted to go see swimming or gymnastics, I could put my name on the list, and they would say, hey, like, you got tickets for this. They're like, oh, sorry, you didn't make it. You know, you signed up too late for it. So you could get free tickets to different events.
Wow.
But you had to, like, put your name on a list kind of thing.
So could someone like me just buy all the Ralph Lauren gear and then just walk around the village and act like an Olympic athlete?
You could, if you could get into the village. So yeah, they sell all their stuff. And I think most of it, at least in an Olympic, you can go on, like, Ralph Lauren right now and, like, buy all the stuff, or, like, Nike, I'm not sure, but I know Ralph Lauren. I saw a bunch of the gear being advertised, but it is hard. It is really hard to get into the village. There's so much security. It's like going through TSA, like, every single time that you have to walk into the building. You have your, like, ID checks, and you're going through scanners, and it'd be really hard for somebody to get in. But if you could do it, you could have all the gear and pretend that you are an Olympian.
Yeah, for sure. Well,
but the question is, what sport would you be if I was like, hey, I've never seen you, like, what sport are you?
I have a confession. I was in Vancouver 2010, and I stayed at a buddy who had worked at Nike, and he had all the official gear. I didn't go into the Olympic. I didn't even know where the Olympic Village was, but I was downtown trying to act like an athlete walking around downtown Vancouver at night.
That is so great. Did you have a sport picked out?
I didn't, but I think I, like, convinced my friends to walk up to me and ask for my autograph so other people would see it. And like, other people are like, oh, are we supposed to know who this person is? And, you know.
Oh, my gosh. That's so funny. You know what is cool, though, is that, and I actually get people asking me this, like, where can you see athletes? Like, if you're, you know, going to watch the Olympics as a spectator. And the thing is, all the athletes are tourists, too, basically. So outside of your event and, like, training times and stuff, you have free reign. You can go see all the sites. Go to the restaurants, and you can go to, like, there's a Team USA house. So, like, Team USA rents out this, you know, well, in Paris this year, it's like a palace, basically. You know, they have different places where you can go, and they call it Team USA house. And you can go there, and athletes and sponsors and everybody can go into the Team USA house and have food and relax and watch games, and there's events and stuff going on. So there's things that are going on out in public. You can be bumping shoulders with an Olympic athlete. They might not be in their gear.
Right.
They might be, but you could be bumping shoulders with an athlete or a sponsor or something wherever you are in that city. So I always say, like, if you're going to be a spectator at the games, talk to everybody around you, because somebody might surprise you and be like, oh, I'm on the Olympic fencing team. You'd be like, wow, I would have never guessed. It's so nice to meet you. It's pretty cool.
That's awesome. There's a great video probably on YouTube now. John Stockton in Barcelona, and he's with his family, and he's got a camcorder, and he's walking up to people that have, like, dream team shirts on, and they have all the players on the shirt or whatever. And he'd be like, who's that guy? And he'd point to himself, and they'd be like, I don't know. I'm not quite sure. You know who Jordan It's pretty funny. It's pretty good.
Oh my gosh, that's great. I'm gonna have to look at that. I love it.
His kids are like, that's him, that's our dad. After they were pretty young.
That's cute.
Craziness. So are you there for the whole Olympic? You're just there for kind of around the time when you're competing, right? So you might be there for a week, not the full 2.5 weeks or whatever.
You get to stay the whole time if you want to.
Oh, wow.
So I competed probably halfway through. Okay. So before then, you're kind of serious. You're more serious, you know, you're in competition mode. And then you get to remain the rest of the time and go see other events or explore, party, whatever you want to do. The whole time there.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay. So you compete, and it was a great experience. And then what happens after the Olympics? Graduate, you go back for senior year, right? You got senior year left.
Yeah, go back to school. So, you know, have this cool experience, go to the Olympics, and then you go to math, accounting.
Yeah, perfect.
I went back to school for my senior year. And so this is why I competed for 3 years, because when I took my time off the previous spring, we apparently didn't do enough research to know that I didn't have enough hours completed towards my degree. So while I was still taking classes, they didn't apply towards my specific degree. So I had to redshirt my senior year.
Oh, no.
So while that was a bummer that I didn't get to compete when I came back, I also got to have a rest after competing for so long and for, you know, everything I had given up basically to train and compete all the time. I finally got to have a little bit of a breather and relax and focus on school. I felt like a bit more of a normal college student that year. And I was still competing on the US team, but it was like a big step back because I wasn't able to practice with the rest of because I was redshirt, I wasn't able to practice with the team. But as an individual sport, I was able to practice on my own time. So, I went back. I didn't compete my senior year, but I was still on the team. You know, I was still on the rifle team there. But I got to finish my degree and graduate. And it was just wonderful. I loved Ohio State. I was sad to leave. So I graduated and I went back and forth. Do I start pursuing a career, start looking for jobs here in the Columbus area, or do I want to keep competing? And I decided I wanted to train full time. So I moved after I graduated to Colorado Springs to train full time at the Olympic Training Center.
Wow. And then did you go in 2016? Where was that at? I'm trying to think.
That was in Brazil.
Was in Brazil. And did you make the team there? Did you go to that?
Wait, was 2016 in Rio? I just said that. Now I'm like, wait a minute. I hope I'm not wrong. Somebody's going to be like, that's not correct. I obviously didn't go to that one. I trained and tried out for it, but I didn't make the team that year. But I had decided already prior to that if I didn't make the team, I was going to retire from shooting after that. You don't make a ton of money as a rifle shooter. Right. And eventually I needed to sustain myself and start building a career. So I decided to focus on career after 2016, put an end to competing, which I still miss it. Sometimes I'm watching competitions or I watch the Olympics come up and I'm like, I should start competing again. And then I think that would take so much time. And I have two little boys and I don't think I have it in me right now to give that much time back to the sport.
You talked a little bit about having a sports psychologist and aside from general mental health, which everyone needs. Can you walk me through what a sports psychologist is doing for you? How they're helpful? Is it visualization stuff? What's that involve?
So yes, it's everything that you could think of that an athlete might struggle with. If they're having a lull in their scores, they're not feeling motivated, mental tricks to work on to calm yourself down. We're talking about breathing. We're talking about physical ways to relax yourself, visualization for sure. That's one of the biggest ones for us. Yeah. But on top of that, general mental health is going to help you almost more than special tips and tricks for helping yourself to focus or relax. So once you've kind of like nailed down the sport side of things, having somebody to speak to about general life circumstances, you know, being a happy person in general is going to help you more in sport than anything else. So once I kind of reached this point of, you know, I've got the competition side down, but like if you're feeling depressed or if you're feeling unhappy, then coming back to that place of happiness and general life satisfaction, it tends to be what actually drives you out of a lull in sport. So it's kind of just maintaining this general like mental health, good mental health, and then fine tuning the sports side of things. It's like a combination of everything. So a really good sports psychologist is focused on all of it. It's a holistic thing. Yeah. So there's a lot to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned Bible reading, which the spirituality is probably a very important part too.
Yeah. And that helped me to reframe, what am I doing this for? And being so self-focused, to more, I'm going to use my talents that I've been given and compete because I love this and to glorify God. So that was really the shift there from, I would say, 2008 to 2012 was like, in 2008, I was so focused on me, 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 for me, I didn't make the team. I need to do this because, you know, I'm good and I've earned this, to more like, you know, that doesn't matter what I've done or where I'm going. What matters is that I've been given this gift and I'm doing this because I love it. And that there's a really big shift between those two trials.
Yeah. Yeah. We have some pretty good discussions here. A couple of faculty are really focused on finding that, finding God in whatever you do, even being a CPA. So,
Totally. I'm telling you, there's a lot of connections between athletic life and professional life.
Yeah. Elaborate on that. How does all these experience and this dedication and this perseverance kind of inform what you do today professionally? And even talk maybe a little about what you're doing today.
So I actually work with my family. We're in we're financial wealth management financial advisors. So, you know, investing in 401ks and everything like that. And that may sound like a world away from what I was doing, but actually, what I tend to speak to people about often, whether it's individuals or retirement groups or, you know, people at companies that we do their retirement plans, I'm speaking to them about goal setting and planning and planning for the future. And that's all stuff that I did. One of the most important things that I did in athletics was goal setting for myself and planning out my future and thinking about what I wanted in the future and how to get there. And that's exactly what we're talking to people about in investing is, where do you want to be and how are you going to get there? What goals do we need to set? What small steps can you take today that are going to build over time and help you to be successful in the future? So that's kind of how I approach it. I do a lot of the financial planning side of things. And that's what I like to talk to people about is, you know, and I don't always relate it back to sport, but often there's a good connection there when I'm speaking with people is just how do we get you from point A to point B in the most relatable way?
Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. And you also have a side gig. You're an adjunct here at Gonzaga.
I am. And that is so cool to me. I remember being like, so I was a kid when like Dan Dickow was the man, like, you know, one of my friends, her mom, worked at Gonzaga and she took us to a basketball game and it was so cool. And so I always, you know, I grew up in Spokane. So Gonzaga is like the heart of Spokane and it's such a fun place to be. And even not having gone to Gonzaga, it still feels like a little bit of a part of my identity. Like even before I was an adjunct, but, cause I grew up as a kid, like seeing these super cool basketball players, you know, that go to GU. And, then I spoke with somebody that was, that worked at Gonzaga and I was saying, oh man, I would love to be an adjunct, but you know, I don't have my PhD or anything like that. And she was like, you don't need your PhD. Let's see it. You know, if there's something you can do to be involved in the school. And so I met with a few different people and we realized, you know, I have my MBA. So, I was able to become an adjunct. And so I'm teaching a class on value investing, which is what the philosophy that we subscribe to at our office. So we're always looking for companies selling for basically a discount to their intrinsic value. So we are looking for sales when we're buying stocks. So I get to teach kids about kids. I feel like I am that much older than them, but I don't feel like it, you know? We're teaching quote unquote kids, they're in the MBA program mostly, about this. And it's really a neat experience because first of all, I never thought that I'd be able to do it, but I found that I really enjoy it and that the students actually absorb the information because it's something that they can apply to their own investing portfolios in their own lives, but also maybe to clients if they're going to be an advisor or work in an area where they are investing clients' money. So I love being part of the Gonzaga community. There's so many ways to get involved. It's like I'm constantly getting emails about different things to do and this different social going on, but also the classes that they offer are just fantastic and can really push kids in the right direction and to learn things that are going to be so valuable in their futures.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's a great community and we're glad to have you a part of it.
Oh, thanks.
super awesome. And the class that you teach, I've heard fabulous reviews, and that's the Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham approach, I believe.
That's right. Yep. We talk about Benjamin Graham, David Dodd, Warren Buffett, a few others. And I'm so happy that you've heard good things. Sometimes I finish a class because I only get to do it, at this point I'm once a year. Yeah. And then it's a whole other year before I teach it again. And I'm like, does anybody even like this class? Is anybody getting anything from this?
I've heard great things.
Oh, good.
I want to be respectful of your time. And so we'll close with the question I always ask. Any advice for newly minted Gonzaga grads or any grads for that matter as they embark on a career or whatever the next chapter in their life is?
Oh yeah. So this is kind of the same thing that I think about. This applies to athletes. So like athletes leaving a career or looking for a career, same thing as people graduating, Gonzaga or other schools. It's all about opportunities. What opportunities do you have? What opportunities can you look for? And so one thing that I always say, especially like, let's say you graduate and you're moving somewhere new, say yes. Say yes as often as you can. Whether it's somebody invites you to something, say yes, go. Have a new experience, meet new people. It just expands your network. That'll expand your opportunities in itself. So I always say go and say yes. And also reach back. So look back at what does Gonzaga offer as far as resources for networking, for job opportunities. Be part of alumni associations because those people are going to be people that you find out that you reach back out to for recommendations or ideas, or they might have something they want you involved in based on what you bring to the table. So I feel like it's really important to stay involved in your communities, your alumni communities, whether that's sport, whether that's your college, whatever that is. Those two things, like always say yes, take advantage of new opportunities and stay in touch with your community.
Awesome. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. So fun. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. See you around.
Okay. Thanks.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world on fire, and go Zags.